Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe.
I'm Justin.
We got a review of Mission Impossible Final Reckoning for you today. Full spoilers ahead. Going from our extreme long shot into our medium shot now. Tell me how much you hated Mission Impossible before this movie.
I really dislike Mission Impossible. I watched the first one, and it was really boring, and I didn't like it that much. But everybody said Mission Impossible was good. So I watched the second one. And it was even worse. It was even more boring. I fell asleep during it. It took me like 3 tries to finally get through it. So I never picked up another Mission Impossible. Until my girlfriend was like, I want to go see the last one. And I was like, well, it's part one, part two. So I guess I have to watch part one. Otherwise, I won't understand anything. And it wasn't bad. Part one wasn't bad. I didn't fall asleep. It wasn't boring. It was fine. Yeah, that's about it.
My history with Mission Impossible is, as a kid, I grew up on the original trilogy. And when I say grew up on, I mean, I watched them. I don't think I've ever seen them more than once. But they were a memorable piece of my movie formation youth. I don't have a good descriptor for that, but just like the movies that define what I think of as decent filmmaking. And they were always impressive as stunt showcases. But where I really started becoming a fan of Mission Impossible was Ghost Protocol, because that was the first Mission Impossible movie I ever saw in theaters. And I've been following the franchise ever since. I've seen everyone from 4 onward in theaters. And I feel like Mission Impossible lives best as a theatrical experience. And why I have more connection with 4 onward. I do think they're better movies than the original trilogy. But also, my experience with the original trilogy was at home on a small screen, which is not where Mission Impossible thrives, is seeing these epic stunt showcases on the big screen, especially from 4 onward, when the stunts just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more death-defying. But getting into our close-up now, my, in a nutshell, opinion of Final Reckoning is it's a touch on the self-indulgent side, but it's a fitting and thrilling finale, which nicely bookends Tom Cruise's iteration of Mission Impossible. There are more callbacks to number one than I expected.
Yeah, I actually knew those ones.
Yeah. Which I do find it really funny from your perspective of a being a Mission Impossible fan, where, like, if you ask Mission Impossible fans, most of them will say the movies you watched are all the worst ones.
Yeah, 4, 5, 6 is where it's at, right?
Yeah, 4, 5, 6.
They're the only ones I haven't seen, basically, and 3.
Even 3 is generally considered, like, they reference 3 in this one, too. But, like, 3, 4, 5, 6 is peak Mission Impossible, 4, 5, 6 especially. And then, like, 1, 2, 7, 8 are, like, on the other sides of those. Not that, like, personally, 7, 8 are better than 1 and 2. But they're still, like,
definitely
on the weaker side of Mission Impossible movies. And it's not, like... See, the problem with Mission Impossible movies, just as a franchise, is you watch them for 2 things. They're not really character-driven movies. They're not really plot-driven movies. They are a third and very rare type of movie. They're a stunt-driven movie. You don't watch them because you care about the character. Like, you don't watch them because you really like the plot or the characters have, like, really interesting arcs. These movies are designed basically top to bottom with, we had a really cool stunt we wanted to have in mind. How do we make the story get here? That's basically how everyone was made, except maybe the first one. I'm not entirely sure. But I feel like every other one was, we've got these stunts we want to do, and how do we get to them? And the characters are just sort of archetypal vessels to get us there. And you also watch them for the charisma of the actors, who are clearly just having a good time, or just doing their jobs very well. Tom Cruise has a blast being this death-defying daredevil. I always really like Benji as well. He came in on the 4th one, but he feels like he's been there forever. And Luther as well. He's been there since the very beginning as well, by Ving Rhames. all the way back from the 90s. Luther's been alongside Ethan, and he gets these friends along the way, and they're all fun. That's what Mission Impossible is all about, is the stunt showcases. And I was surprised to find that the stunts didn't come for a very long time into the movie. Not that I wasn't enjoying it, but there was a certain point where, like, I think he was on the submarine heading to the other submarine, and this is like nearly halfway through the movie, and I'm like, I don't think there's been a single stunt yet. This entire first half of the movie is just exposition dumping and getting the pieces into play for the back half, and the back half's when stuff really... Well,
the back half is excellent. The first half was...
Gotta get us there.
Slow.
Like I said, self-indulgent. There's a lot of flashbacks to previous Mission Impossible movies. Lots of building up the team for their final adventure of like, oh man, the stakes are so high. And I think the worst part about the first half is the recapping of what happened in Dead Reckoning. Takes up a lot of time.
Yeah, when you do a part one, it's specifically a part one, part two. Don't waste that much time. Everybody watched the part one. If you're going into part two, you should have watched part one. Don't waste time doing that.
Like, if I recall, there were two exposition dumps, basically. There was a visual one and a verbal one. In the opening sequence with the classic Mission Impossible lines burning down to the end, you see a lot of clips from the last movie, basically. Last time on Mission Impossible, sort of recap. And then the movie actually starts, and
it essentially has a recap.
Yeah,
and there then as well in the mission summary.
Yeah, because we, you know, it's Mission Impossible, and we have to do the, if you choose to accept it, sort of mission. But the way they did it in this movie was like, you did the same information dump twice, and that scene took up at least 5 minutes more than it needed to be for an already
long
movie. So the beginning kind of starts slow. But what I will say is, you have me locked in right from the very beginning. You lost me a bit with the exposition dumping, but as soon as that score kicks in right from the start, and the tether is getting burnt down, you know, that always builds my hype every single time when I watch these movies. It's never not awesome hearing that score. It just, like, really hypes you up for a good time.
It can't be denied. It's the score makes it, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a relic of the 1960s TV show.
Is it really?
Yep, that was the theme for the original.
Wow!
Same kind of thing as James Bond for spy movies. You know, they've been using their themes for 60 years because they were great to begin with.
That's crazy. I did not know that.
Even like with the line burning down, that was the original Mission Impossible title sequence too. Like that's what they did in the 60s show. Mind you, I've only seen like two episodes of that show. But I don't know if you knew this before I told you, but that was kind of the big controversy of Mission Impossible 1, was they took the character of Jim Phelps, who was the protagonist of the old show, and spoilers for Mission Impossible 1, but you wouldn't be here if you haven't seen it. They turned Jim Phelps into the villain of Mission Impossible 1. Well, first they killed him off in the first act, which has already probably pissed a lot of people off. But then in the last act, he comes back and he's a rogue agent. He's a villain. And people were, even the original actor who played Jim Phelps, I believe I read somewhere that he was considered for the role in the movie, but he didn't want to do it because they're like, you turned my character into a bad guy. That's not who this character was to me. That's not what he represents. And basically, from movie one, all original Mission Impossible fans wrote off the Tom Cruise version. You don't really find fans of both the original series and the movies. More people are familiar with the movies, though, so I'd say they won in the term of cultural awareness, but that is a brief history on the schism of the Mission Impossible fan base. There's the TV fans and the movie fans.
I didn't even know there was a TV show. So,
well, because most of the people who watched it are like your grandparents' age or older. I think
Fair.
Leonard Nimoy was on it for a stint. He was one of the main cast for a while. Or like a recurring character. but he's the only one I can name off the top of my head who was like a big name on that show. But I don't, like I said, I've only seen like a few episodes of it. But going back to Jim Phelps, what I like about my entire point in all that spiel is to say that they revealed the character of Brinks to be Jim Phelps' son, who, and I really like that because Brinks is kind of a jerk, but he is a good guy. He is kind of a, he is a good agent. And I feel like 30 years late, that's sort of an apology to original Mission Impossible fans who are like, okay, we turned Jim Phelps into a bad guy, but his son's good. His legacy in this world carries on it for good reasons. And that's like, okay, so maybe rest a little bit easier about our legacy of the original show. That's how I took it with that twist, which I appreciated just knowing about that schism. I'm like, I don't know how many people will really care, but I think that's nice that they called back to Ethan's original mentor and the original show just in general. But there's also a lot of other bookends in this, like the sonar scientist that they meet most of the way through the movie was the guy who designed the vault Ethan broke into in the original, which I haven't seen the original, like I said, in, you know, 15 years. So if you were to just show me this guy without the flashbacks, I wouldn't have recognized him. But then they show the flashbacks of, oh, this is the original actor from right after that famous hanging on the wire scene comes in and finds the knife. I'm like, oh, wow, like clips from the original movie 30 years ago. And like, I wouldn't have recognized you otherwise. It just off like for that brief role that he had. But I really like the use of flashbacks to connect things throughout the legacy of the franchise. And even characters like that came back. And I also believe his boss, Kittredge, it was kind of a big deal. He came back in Dead Reckoning because he hadn't been seen since the first movie. I think he was also Ethan's boss in the first movie. And then he kind of disappeared for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but then they brought him back in 7.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, he's been in every single one I've seen.
Well, yeah, because he disappeared in all the ones you haven't. He just wasn't there. And people are like, wow, Kittredge is back. Cool. So you kind of, you have him in here too. He's an original. You have Ethan. You have that guy from the vault and Luther as well, which, you know, for setting up stakes, they had to kill Luther third of the way into this movie, which sucks because fan favorite. But yeah, I mean, I guess they figured if you're gonna try to set up this story has any stakes, you kill off an original. And even like nearly killing Benji at the end there was also like, oh man, this is like the guy who's been there the second longest. Like, we don't care as much about people like, okay, like Paris and Grace were just introduced in the last movie. So we're like, okay, you could kill them off, but also we're not really,
it wouldn't work,
super attached to them. Like, at least what's her name? Rebecca Ferguson's character in Dead Reckoning. I don't remember her character's name in the movie, but like at least she'd been around for a couple of movies. She'd been around since number 5. It's like, okay, fine. This is like the third movie and this is like her trilogy end and she died in that one. Okay. But this one was the last one, so you needed to kill an original. I'm shocked Ethan Hunt made it to the end.
I thought for sure he was done.
I mean, he did. I think he died in the middle after the submarine stunt.
Well, technically, yes, yeah.
But, like, he got preserved and revived after the decompression. And I'm like, okay, you killed him halfway through the movie. Movie got its cake and ate it too.
So, do you want to talk about the stunts now?
I just wanted to double back a second, talk about Luther, which I thought his death scene was good, but I was disappointed that they kind of glossed over it very quickly afterwards. It was never really brought up again until the very ending when he was the guy who designed the pod. I'm like, okay, so he got his message to Ethan at the very end. But then most of the movie is like, okay, he dies and then we just like run right through. which I understand it's like the world's ending and we don't have time to really mourn or reflect on this, but it was just like, it could have hit a little bit harder right after for one of the originals. But yeah, let's get into the stunts now, which really there's two main ones to talk about here. There's the submarine one and the plane one. Which do you feel like addressing?
Well, I was on the edge of my seat the entire submarine section. That was very intense. That whole segment, the whole scene, it built the tension slowly. It set up, it gave you the little bit of foreshadowing with stuff, and it built tension through the entire scene till like stuff hits the fan and it's just absolutely like,
for sure.
It was incredibly tense. I think that whole sequence was extremely well done. Like, extremely well done.
I'm not sure how practical it was in terms of effects work when he's leaving the one submarine and bouncing off the other one.
Mm.
I'm not sure how they got that all. Like, it looked great. But I do know that for the actual part where he's in the crashed submarine, they built a 1,000-ton gimbal rig to flip this tank over and it could pivot at different angles. I read that it took them 2 years to build the set.
Holy cow.
And 15 days alone just to fill it with water.
There's a lot of water in that scene.
Yeah. Which, this is what Mission Impossible does. It goes above and beyond, and if you want an underwater scene, you do it right. And I also saw that Christopher McQuarrie apparently directed Tom Cruise from within the tank, because apparently they had some distaste for how they handled the scene in Rogue Nation, where he was holding his breath underwater for 6 minutes, because Christopher McQuarrie directed it from afar. Like, there were cameras in the water to see what Tom Cruise was doing, and he's like, I'm just directing him based on what I can see. But he was like, no, for this one, I want to be in the environment and direct him based on what I can see, not just what I'm seeing off a camera of this thing. Which I think made the scene definitely, it was great. Him just being in that environment and getting the feel for it, it comes through better. That's for sure. And I really liked the stunt in Rogue Nation as well. They did really well the first time, but they topped themselves here. And I think it was also the same article which mentioned that in this stunt, the missiles were heavy because it said that if the missiles were too light, it would have been obvious. You could tell.
Yeah.
So when the torpedoes are falling on him, they could have crushed him if he was at the wrong position, if he missed his mark. And the stunt coordinator was like, you know, some of these scenes look like he's actually drowning. I don't know if he's acting or actually drowning. And apparently he stepped in and Tom Cruise was like, what the heck, man? You ruined my take. He's like, oh, sorry, I thought you were drowning. It's like, no, leave it. We got signals for when I'm actually in trouble. Which, yeah, it was a very dangerous thing altogether. They are under actual water and in a moving environment with missiles that could crush you.
Yeah, and it looked fantastic. I just love the way that they set the scene first by having him go through slowly.
The whole environment.
You know, they did set up that it's kind of pivoting a little bit, but he walked through, he went through the environment. We saw him do it really slowly, really carefully.
Yes.
So you kind of knew everything that was coming when it came to the big action sequence. Everything was set already. The pieces were all set up. It was great.
Yeah, definitely. I also love the visual style of it, even just the slow descent down to the water when he's shooting the flares off. I thought it was gorgeous to look at.
Yeah, that was really cool.
I'm like, wow, these underwater scenes, like they feel deep and dark, and most of the light is lit diegetically with the flares, or at least that's the way they're making it seem like.
Well, and I like how essentially he only said two words the entire part, from the second he left the submarine to getting out of the ice. He said two words, and it was the torpedo tube. Right. That was it. And that was the only thing that I had in that scene. I thought that kind of took me out of it, but at the same time, I wouldn't have known what his plan was without that dialogue. That felt like that was added later. Because the whole time he didn't say a single word.
Mm. You reminded me earlier of the interesting fact about the torpedo tube, having watched Dead Reckoning a little more recently than I did.
Yeah. So when he opened the first one, he's like, oh man, there's a torpedo in there. But as the audience would know, or maybe from some of the flashbacks at the beginning, that submarine went down by shooting one torpedo that came around, blew itself up. So there was one spot, and maybe Ethan Hunt, maybe he knew that, but maybe not. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it was cool that there was like, as the audience, you're like, oh, is he going to try again? Because I know there's one that's empty.
For sure. I'm not quite sure how he got out the other side. I don't know if that's like an easy door to prop open from the inside, but
they kind of glossed over that.
Yeah, they're like, forget it. Or like that he cut off his wetsuit to get there. Like, oh, he's in very, very cold water. So I've seen some criticism that like, he probably would have gotten shocked just from...
immediately,
just
much.
From that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, all right. So we're kind of glossing over the escape part.
Yeah, it was still well done. I didn't think about that when I was watching the movie. It didn't take me out of anything.
Yeah, but in terms of like the actual filmmaking craft of like we're nitpicking real world details here in a movie
it's a movie. It glosses over things.
But in terms of filmmaking craft, of you set up the danger of this submarine, you have really. And the danger to him personally, even like everything with the wetsuit and the decompression, you have him go down there beautifully with the flares, exploring the submarine. Starts tipping, obstacles, things are going wrong, the rooms are filling with water.
And the fact that they already gave him like you got 10 minutes and this is how much time you have or you're basically toast. Like they already kind of set everything up with the timing and that he was already pretty deep. And then the submarine goes deeper and you're like, uh-oh.
You really felt the depth as he was going down. I appreciated the editing of it, if only because they didn't choose to cut away to anything else. They just let the sequence go and just let you live in this claustrophobic environment with him.
Oh, if they broke it up, I don't think it would have worked the same because it was so well done that it kept you feeling in this tight environment with the water coming in. And I think that was something interesting too, was the constant addition of water.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it just made it more uncomfortable that it's like every room he goes into was sealed and then there's more water coming in. And
I really feel like most movies would not have respected their audience's patience enough to let us just sit with this.
Mm-hmm.
They would have been like, they're probably getting bored of the submarine thing. Let's move on to whatever the others are doing.
I was glad that for a movie that my main criticism was that it was too long, the slow action scene was paced perfectly. I wouldn't even shave like 1 second off that scene. It was so well done.
Yeah, it's a whole really well done sequence. And I know I understand the praise for that and I love that one, but I personally love the plane ones even more. If only because not that the fact that it was the submarine set was not dangerous, but there's a part of me that's like, well, you know, I can still feel like this is a set, and the fact that like you're setting up this kind of illusion of being really deep underwater, there's still a part of me that's like, okay, well, I know he's in a tank and it is dangerous, but I know he's not like actually that deep underwater.
See, I think that's where our experiences with Mission Impossible make it different, because I'm approaching it as a movie, not a stunt showcase.
Yeah, but when I watched the plane sequence, I'm like, okay, the long shots and the plane, I'm like, I know he's really that high up and doing death-defying stunts in the air. I'm like, in, I guess altitude's the name of the game in this one. You're like really far below the sea surface. You're really high above and biplanes. And the one below the sea surface, I'm like, I know he's not actually that deep or going to experience the bends or anything, or like, or the decompression that they're talking about. I'm like, it's dangerous in a different way, but not the way the movie's describing it. Whereas the biplane sequence, it just is what it is. They don't need to tell me how dangerous it is, because I can just see it. I can see the ground. I can see how high up they are. I can see Tom Cruise's face rippling from the high speeds. When my favorite shot in the plane sequence is when the plane's getting flipped over, and he's like, he's about to fall off it. He's trying to get his grip. But then when the plane is doing a barrel roll, gravity kind of stops right in the middle of the wing, and he gets a second.
Cool.
I have a second to like floating and falling in the middle of the biplane wing here to recompose myself.
Well, and after that point, he started taking advantage more of that gravity effect.
Yeah. He was thinking about it a little bit more,
which I thought was really cool. And then he used that against him by forcing the rudder on the wing, basically, to move or not move.
Yeah, he was starting to control his environment a little bit more, which I still think it's pretty crazy. He's got to climb up to the one plane, knock the pilot out, Indiana Jones style, get in the cockpit, get onto a different plane after that.
The whole like back half of the movie felt real like the Indiana Jones to me.
For sure.
And maybe that's why I had a better time with it, maybe, but
I can definitely see the plane sequence being like something out of Indiana Jones, for sure.
The punches.
Do they even use the same sound effect? Am I misremembering that?
Maybe. I don't know. It seemed like an Indiana Jones classic move. Like, holy.
I definitely thought of Indiana Jones when he punched the pilot out.
And even the last sequence where they went to kind of felt like an old temple.
That's true.
It just, and with like the crew following him, like it just, I was like, there was a point during the movie that I was like, this feels like I'm watching Indiana Jones.
Yeah. And I think that's one reason Mission Impossible, well, I'll double back to what I was going to say before. But the reason Mission Impossible 8 started feeling like that for you, I think the other ones spread their stunts more throughout. Like, most of the movies aren't so front-loaded with stuff, and then, like, the action only kicks up halfway through. A lot of them start with a big action stunt showcase, and then, like, maybe one in the middle, one in the third act. There's, like, usually two or three, and they're spread out. This one was, like, this movie was front-loaded with exposition, and then saved all the really cool stuff for the back half, for the midpoint in the back half, which, you know, they're making us wait for it a little bit more. But that's why I can see it being a bit more controversial, because it's more dialogue based and we're here for the stunts. Where's the stunts?
I got a question about stunts.
Yeah.
This might be a little off topic.
All right.
Was the train sequence in the last one a stunt? Like the climb up? Or was that just...
I don't know about the climb up, but I know like part of the entry was him riding the motorcycle off the cliff and parachuting.
Yeah, that was a big stunt.
That was a stunt. Obviously not the part where he parachutes into the plane and everything, but I'm not sure about the climbing up the cars. I wouldn't be surprised. Not that, like, the cars were hanging over a cliff, but there probably was.
Like, basically a vertical set piece.
There probably was. Mission Impossible has built its reputation in the last 15 years specifically, not so much the original trilogy, but from 4 on, they're very much known for these things are happening in some version of reality. Even if, once again, it's not like, I know he's not at the seafloor doing this. He is still doing this, and there is an element of real danger involved.
Mm-hmm.
So I would not be surprised, not knowing 100% that it was a real train set car and they're working up vertically.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
With like things dropping on them or whatever to add some danger.
Because that sequence looked really good in that one. I thought that was...
Yeah.
It
is a franchise known for its practical effects work. Like, there are special effects, obviously. But when you see a stunt done in these,
it's they're usually practical.
They're usually done for real to some extent. Which is, once again, like, the plane sequence, it blows me away. I see that, and I'm like, this... I've seen 100 years worth of movies, but that plane sequence in particular is like, this is one of the best stunt showcases I've ever seen in my life. Just getting in the plane and getting the plane wings smashed by the other plane, and he's got to get in the other one and ride in the zero gravity between the wings and then do the flaming parachute jump out.
See, to the ground. That changes my opinion of that scene, because when I came out of the movie, I thought that scene could have been shorter. It seemed fairly long.
Yeah.
But now that you're telling me that it was done for real, it kind of makes sense why things took so long.
Yeah.
Because he really is climbing up. Realistic, I guess.
Because those planes are moving at really high speeds. And like, yeah, in most movies, it would take him a shorter amount of time to climb up to the cockpits or whatever. But the planes are moving at really high speeds and he actually has to fight the wind and climb up. Like, he actually, I read Tom Cruise passed out multiple times doing that scene.
Okay, so I forgive it for being a little bit long then.
Yeah, and he also did the flaming parachute jumps, which apparently he set a Guinness World Record for. Although, wherever I read that joke that it was like, I don't know how many other people were doing this to start. He might be the only contender, but... I think he did that jump 16 times or something crazy. Where it was the parachute catches on fire, he falls for a bit, and then he ejects the safety chute.
Speaking of that scene, I loved that the bad guy, what's his... I don't remember what his name was. I loved that, like, the whole movie and the last one, he's just going hardcore, like, villain, like, straight to the bone villain. He was awesome. I loved him in both of these movies.
Yeah, he's good.
And it was so satisfying having him, like, I'm getting away. Boom. I was like, oh. That was a satisfying end for him there. That was pretty cool.
He's so close.
Only one of us has a parachute. Okay. He's done.
He hit the back of the wing, right?
Yeah.
I watched it like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Like, literally, instantly, he's like, bye bye, boom, cracks his head open. And you're like, oh.
That's one of the funniest villain tries to escape scenes I've ever seen.
It was great.
Yeah.
Especially that it played into the fact that, like, how dangerous the stunt really would have been for Tom Cruise. Like, not, but like Ethan Hunt's character.
It could have been him.
It was, you know, it really played into the danger, even going back to something like the submarine, like the very close calls he had in this movie. And then it's like, okay, the bad guy is going to get away. Whack. Like, it was just like that. Just, it was that easy. One mistake and he was dead.
Yeah.
And he was thinking and he was plan, like, this was his plan, was to do that.
That's true.
He was like, I got a parachute. I'm going to get away. And one slip up, he was dead.
Definitely. Now, my one criticism of the scene has more to do for plot purposes, where I'm like, so did this pod have Wi-Fi or something? I thought they might need to get it to the physical location to make it work, but he plugs it in.
As far as I understood,
as he's parachuting down.
The way they, I think they changed it from the first, like, part one made it sound like it was on the internet. part two made it sound like it was that drive was it's the AI's home base, essentially. It was relaying itself out from there in a way. So whatever that drive's technology was basically gave it connection wherever it needed to go.
I guess so. If it could transmit from the bottom of the sea, it could transmit from
wherever, basically.
I guess so. I guess when I was watching it, I was more under the understanding that like the thing's brain lived in there, but when they removed it from the ship, I'm like, okay, I guess the connection's broken and it's just living in this like off the grid box now. But then he plugged the virus back into it and it did exactly what they wanted it to. I'm like, oh, I didn't realize this thing was connected still. Okay, that's convenient. But also, it was set up, kind of.
It wouldn't make sense if they took it. Then the movie would have ended after the submarine scene. All you had to do was get it out. Okay, it's done. We got it in the drive.
To be fair, they did set it up that even if they got it out of the submarine, it's everywhere now.
Yeah.
That was just the original source code that was in that thing.
Yeah.
That they could build a virus based off of. So, like, I do disagree that it would have ended it because it already did spread. They didn't need it.
I guess so. Yeah, that's fair.
I was just under the impression that...
They made it sound like that drive was kind of its home base, which is why it was trying to transfer to that vault or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in terms of that villain, the entity sort of takes a backseat in this movie compared to the last one. It feels like an ongoing threat. But besides that one scene where it comes to Ethan in the box, which was a threatening scene, but also I'm like, is it a mind reader now? I don't understand its powers when it's like projecting images into his mind and reading.
They kind of set that up in the first movie where it was like, yeah, you know, it can see the future. It's written. It's, you know, they kind of went with that already, that it can it knows exactly what everyone's going to do. But then they really leaned in on it in this one where it was like, yeah, it knows everything. It knows what you're going to do.
Yeah, that's really the only scene we really had with it in this one, though.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what's his name? Was it Gabriel?
Gabriel, that's it. Yep.
Otherwise, Gabriel was the stand-in villain for this, which I did think it was kind of a funny expositional thing afterwards where they're like, yeah, he failed the entity in the first one, so he's a free agent now. And he's trying to control the entity this time.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And I also liked how nobody else knew what to do with it. All the government people were like, okay, we kind of want to control it. And nobody wants to shut down their armaments when they had the chance. Before the entity takes everything up, the only smart play was to shut the armaments, but everyone's paranoia was stopping them from doing that. So the entity got control of the world's nuclear weapons because of that. It's just this level of nobody can trust each other. I'd say the main theme of this movie was paranoia. And that's nearly what led to humanity's downfall, was because nobody was like, we all see the threat in front of us, and the only play is to shut down our arsenal.
And nobody will do it.
But they're like, well, if we shut down our arsenal, what if the entity fires on us first? Then we'll be defenseless. Or what if our enemies, who still have control, fire on us because we're defenseless? Everyone needs to do it, but nobody trusts that everyone's going to do it.
I think another element that was in the same vein was that idea that, like, the president and her friend were like, oh, there was this incident that happened, and the reason she gave him a chance was because nobody, no higher up would give a chance to something for that incident, like the whatever it was, the letter that just had the date.
Yeah. I don't remember what that was about now. I remember it happening.
Essentially, the president and the big ship, the aircraft carrier commander, both had an event that happened on the date or whatever, where the higher-ups refused to act when
they needed
to. because it was risky or whatever. So that was the reason why she gave Ethan a chance, basically.
Yeah,
even though it was completely against what anybody else wanted.
It was against the common sense of the military, which I do respect that the movie didn't go out of its way to be like, these guys are idiots, because you do kind of understand their point of view. You're like, okay, from a military tactical point of view, I completely understand what you're saying of, what do you mean we want to disarm ourselves on the hope that all our enemies are going to disarm as well and leave us defenseless against the entity and countries we don't trust to begin with? It doesn't make much tactical sense on the offhand chance that this guy who's gone rogue about a million times by now is single-handedly, alongside his rogue team, gonna stop this thing. It's a lot of faith to put in an impossible mission, basically. Yes, we know Ethan Hunt's done impossible missions a lot by this point. But also, there's no reason to trust he's going to succeed again.
Yeah, I feel lied to. It's called Mission Impossible, but every Mission Impossible I've watched, the mission was possible. So,
yeah.
I think that's false advertising.
Well, this is the only one that literally killed him halfway through.
But the mission was still possible.
He did it.
Either way, even if he actually died, he still got the thing to the surface. If he died there, he still won.
That's true.
Or most of the way.
All they needed was to dig his body out. And
yeah, and they had what they needed. He succeeded on the first mission, no problem.
Yep, that is true. But I do understand the military's point of view. Most movies would just be like,
military bad.
Military bad. Our hero's the only one who knows what he's talking about. I'm like, look, he's got like a high plot armor. So I know he's probably like, okay, until the third act. And he'll do most of what he wants to do. But I understand why the military doesn't think he can. It makes perfect sense in most of the context. It was just that last bit of the president being like, no, okay, I can't press the button. I can't fire the nukes in what was our joke in Battle for Blood? Preeminent self-defense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what else about this movie? Yeah, I think another thing besides the paranoia was it hammered home the idea of individuality is an integral human trait. You have these collective bodies like the military who are all pushing an agenda that's not really in anybody's best interest, even though it sounds good on paper. But it's like the rogue agents like Ethan Hunt who are independent and capable. They're the ones who drive the most necessary change. It's about the importance of individuals with skill to just do the things they can do. And that's how the world gets saved. It's not the governing bodies or groups of decision makers that are just going to get bogged down in tedious debates. It's like individuals take the action that...
You're right. There were actually lots of individuals who made moves.
Yeah.
Like the aircraft carrier woman, the guy in the main submarine,
Yep. Just well, anybody who did anything of value.
Yeah, like lots of people took risks on the words of individuals, basically. The guy at the outpost.
Yep.
You know,
he didn't have to run back into the fire.
Even the president herself made individual moves.
She made a call at the end.
You're right. It was a lot of people in collectives that made individual moves that would go against
what the collective thought was a good idea.
Yeah.
And that's what saved everybody in the end. Which I think there was a line. It was either a line or just something I had, an idea I had highlighted in my notes here. which is the sum of infinite choices makes us and changes the future. I think that may have been a line in the movie. But it's all these individuals making choices, and it's the sum of those choices that is whatever tomorrow is, basically. So it's kind of hammering home the be an individual, do what you do best, make choices, which is good. Good message. I agree with that.
So this is the last one, right?
Allegedly.
Because I don't think they could go much higher than the whole world's going about to launch all their nukes and destroy all human population.
Well, what I believe is probably going to happen is this will be the last one with Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie directing it. The thing about Mission Impossible is this is kind of a thing going back to the original series, but also kind of in the original movie as well, is that you kind of have a protagonist like Jim Phelps or Ethan Hunt, and it's all about them picking their teams and going on missions. Like in the original, Ethan Hunt was just part of Jim Phelps' team, and then he kind of spun off and became the main character. But it's not very difficult to imagine a world where we just follow a new protagonist who has the authority to make their own new team in the IMF.
No, I can buy that, but like I was sitting there and it's like, okay, well, what if what's her name wants to
Grace or
yeah,
Paris?
It's like, well, but then you think about it and you're like, well, I'm pretty sure Tom Cruise is the only actor who's willing to who with a big enough name to pull the franchise.
That's also
and
true.
Willing to do these stunts. Mission Impossible, like you've said before, it's nothing without its stunts.
That's right? What it's known for.
So who's going to take up that mantle that's got a big enough name that can pull, continue to pull the franchise? I don't know if that's why I think this probably will be the last one.
And like I said, Christopher McQuarrie is another big element to this as well, because there's been 8 Mission Impossible movies and he's done the last 4 of them.
Mm.
He's directed half the franchise as it's known today. So between him and Tom Cruise, they're the ones who kind of revitalized Mission Impossible and kept it relevant all these years. The only way to do it is pull a Marvel and do multiverse. No, that is not how you handle Mission Impossible.
No, I just mean
you got to strip back.
Even if they do strip back, even if they go to smaller stuff, I don't know how they'll find an actor with a big enough name. Like that's kind of a one-off that Tom Cruise is like, yeah, I want to do crazy stunts and almost die every time.
I mean, actors like going a little bit older, like Harrison Ford likes doing a lot of his own stuff too, but like not to the same extent. There are actors out there who it's will just do it, but are they, as you said, the kind who can carry their own franchise?
Yeah, that's the thing. You need a big name to carry the franchise. You can't use an unknown. I don't think an unknown can pull a franchise as big as Mission Impossible.
Yeah, that's the only way forward is a soft reboot or a full-on reboot at this point.
Well, like they can bring a new character in, but you have it's the actor, that's the personality of the actor that's going to do it.
Yeah.
And I just don't know who's out there who will actually be interested in doing these types of stunts. Unless you've got like Tom Holland wants to do crazy stunts. I don't know. I don't even know if he could pull a franchise like this.
No, you know, I was thinking about Tom Holland and I'm like, you know, he did the Uncharted movie and that was like some stunt work in that, but mostly barely. Like CGI. And
yeah.
So you either compromise the character of the franchise by making it more CGI heavy effects work stunt, which is like, that's not what it's known for at this point. It's known as the practical stunt showcase franchise.
And Uncharted was the movie was none of the stunts were that impressive.
No,
they didn't feel that good. And that's probably because there was no practical work on it.
Now, I know somebody like Tom Holland, he's an acrobat. He's got a great physicality about him. There's a lot of stuff he can do. when given the opportunity. But Tom Cruise is such a versatile stunt performer because he can do the submarine scenes, he can do the plane scenes, he can hang off the side of the Burj Khalifa, he can hold his breath underwater for 6 minutes like he did in Rogue Nation, he can take injuries on set like in Fallout when he broke his foot jumping between buildings, he can do something like the wire stunt from the first one, smaller scale, he can ride the motorcycles, he can drive the cars, he can fly fighter jets and planes like he does
and
in Top Gun.
It's actually believable.
He does all of it.
Like the way he plays the character, you believe that he can do these things.
And he does do them.
Yeah.
In real life, he does all these things.
And that's the thing is, I can't think of another actor who you could believably do that with a big enough name to pull the franchise and do the stunt work.
Yeah.
That's why I really do think this might be the last one. Even though big franchises never want to die out, I don't know if anybody's going to be willing to put the money down and be like, okay, we're going to do Mission Impossible, but without the stunts? I just don't think that Mission Impossible fans will go for that.
I think at this point, one of the only ways to do it is strip it back down to kind of the original TV show or Mission Impossible 1. Where it's low stakes, like Mission Impossible 1, the biggest stunt is him hanging off a wire and he can't touch the floor. They built up crazy, obviously, over the last 30 years, but going back to more that original spy-focused thing where it's like, okay, there's like the face masks and secret identities and actually infiltrating bad guys and like bring it back more to classic spy fare with a stunt flavoring. I don't think movie audience, like, you're going to lose a lot of people, but that's kind of the only way I can see to move forward.
That's the thing is, if Mission Impossible fans don't like the first two, and I very much do not like the first two, do we want to go back to that?
Yeah, I feel like there may be three subsets of Mission Impossible fans. There's like the classic TV show fans, there's like fans of the original trilogy, and then there's fans of 4 onward.
Stunts, stunts, stunts.
Yeah, which is me. I'm a fan of 4 onward. But you see, the problem is more grounded stuff. You're getting into like James Bond or Jason Bourne territory. But like James Bond is infinitely redoable because the character has a very set defining features and personality traits, and somebody like Daniel Craig can do like the parkour and Casino Royale and like the, he can do the hand-to-hand fist fights and like, yeah, that's really cool. Other guys like Sean Connery, I don't think were really doing their own stunts in the 60s. Like, you can have more badass actors to take on the role, but it still feels like James Bond at the end of the day. You're not recasting Ethan Hunt. No. Ethan Hunt's not the kind of character. Once again, the plot has never really been the main thing. Ethan Hunt isn't a character with enough depth that you even kind of want to redo him. It's just,
no, there's no point.
It's Tom Cruise's charisma on screen, pure and simple. That's all Ethan Hunt is.
And that's why I think this is going to show the weakness of the franchise as being a mega franchise.
Yeah.
Is that it's not plot driven. Nobody watches these movies for the plot.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I do, but.
And you've already done all the coolest stunts in 8 movies.
Yeah.
It took you 30 years and 8 movies, and this is it.
I mean, maybe they'll try and make another one, but I don't see it being very successful.
I struggle to envision a future where it is.
And I think studios, especially in the landscape we're in now, where they're kind of starting to be like, oh, we're losing money. I feel like that will make them more hesitant, especially to be like, we don't know if this is going to work.
300 million plus budgets and
yeah,
stuff like this, which I do think stripping it back would be a good idea, because I remember getting out of the theater. My dad mentioned that, and I agreed with him, that the movie loses its reality at a certain point. You go from Mission Impossible 1, even 4, 5, and 6 were like a level of grounded, but 7 to 8 go to world-ending stakes. And it's like, we pushed ourselves very, very far. The sweet spot for Mission Impossible is like not world ending stakes, not even like country ending stakes, but like stuff is happening.
Middle stakes.
Yeah, middle stakes is the sweet spot. And that's why a lot of people don't like 7 and 8 as much, because it went too big, because everything does world-ending stakes, universe-ending stakes now.
It built up there, though.
Oh, no, it was a gradual increase over the years. But I think audiences are tired of world-ending stakes.
Yeah. It's low, overdone.
Low stakes is coming back into vogue. I can see the trend. So I think Mission Impossible, if it continues forward, will have to take that route. But it will be interesting to see. I think the franchise is dead for at least a couple of years, though. I give it no more than 5 years minimum. It's probably dead right now. And I don't know how. And that's like 5 years till they start developing the next one. And I can see a world where Tom Cruise stays on to produce this franchise, but
no, he's going to come back at 70 and do another one.
That's not going to be that long from now, is the thing.
That's what I mean. He's already like 64 or 5 or something. He's in his 60s already. So
62.
Oh, is he 62?
So when you say come back in his 70s to do it, I'm like, that's 8 years away.
And you're like, wait. Give it a 5 year gap before we make another one. He's going to be almost 70. I bet you that's what it'll do. He's probably going to get bored in 8 years and be like, I'm still alive.
I think he's working on Top Gun 3 next.
Yeah, he'll work on Top Gun 3. And then he'll be bored. And then, like, in 10 years, he'll do one more Mission Impossible in his 70s. And
yeah.
They wouldn't let me do that many stunts on Top Gun 3. I wanted to do more death-defying stunts. You're almost 70, man.
Flying the fighter jet was enough. I wanted to ride it on the outside. They wouldn't let me.
Listen, I bought Fast and the Furious so that I can send Mission Impossible to space.
Yeah. That's,
we're going to combine the two like long-running franchises into one and send Ethan Hunt to space with the Fast and Furious crew.
Mission Impossible is just such, it's just so weird as a movie franchise. I can't think of very many franchises that have lasted this long with the same core cast of characters. Like Ving Rhames and Tom Cruise have been doing these movies since the mid-90s. And they're still going with a real consistency in terms of quality, and it's going to be very hard for anyone to adapt going forward. I can't imagine a series starting now with that kind of longevity. Think about it. Even somebody like Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man only got an 11-year run. Tom Cruise has been doing this since 1996.
And doing action like stunt heavy?
Oh, yeah. Holy. The entire time. And getting the stuff he was doing in his 20s in 1996 was a lot less strenuous than the stuff he's doing at 62.
He's doing the most strenuous stuff at his oldest age.
Yeah. Holy. I can't imagine 90s Tom Cruise doing the submarine or the plane stunts from Dead Reckoning.
No, I don't think he'd have the physicality to do it. He wasn't very big back then.
No, he was kind of
he's like
skinny guy.
Solid muscle now.
Yeah. So it's yeah, it's definitely a weird one. They're going to have troubles. But I'm glad Dead Reckoning was like I said, it's a bit self-indulgent. Lots of flashbacks and stuff, which I enjoy to an extent. And lots of exposition dumping. But it's enjoyable. As a movie, just as like a, hey, let's see a good stunt movie. It's a good bookend to Mission Impossible, and whatever they do going forward, I don't really care. They wrapped up the stories of the people I cared about and entertained me in the process, so.
Well, what do you give it?
I think I'm going to have to stick with my middle of the road rating and say it's worth a watch. The difference I find between worth a watch and my next one up pretty darn good is an element of rewatchability. I'm glad I saw this. I was very in. This is kind of like a high scale worth a watch because I'm like, there are parts I would rewatch, but I don't know if I'd want to sit down and rewatch the entire movie again. Not anytime soon, anyway. I rewatched the big stunt sequences. Those are like 5 to 10 minutes each. I enjoy this movie in large sequences, but not necessarily all the way through again, but it is worth a watch. Oh, and I forgot, before you do your ranking, there's a big element to this movie I never even talked about was the editing. I don't know if you caught the, I really love what they did with match cutting between scenes, where there's like exposition dumps happening and like Tom Cruise is doing an exposition dump to his crew and then there's like another scene happening as well. But the mm-hmm. way it's cut and framed, it's like, okay, he's talking to you, like I'm talking to you, but when we cut back to where you, like my eye line's going this way, but when we cut to you, the eye lines are staying the same, but it's a whole different group and the conversation keeps flowing. They did that multiple times. And I just thought it was a really cool way to keep the flow going. It was like the scenes it's like the scenes were blocked.
Overlapped and...
Yeah. The scenes were blocked to keep a consistent flow going, but they were two different scenes. Like the conversation was continuing, the editing and the flow was continuing. Like it was bouncing back and forth in the same room nearly, but it was just... They did that multiple times and I just thought the editing was really cool. Just different. Clever match cutting there. But yeah, that was my last thought. What's your...
Well, I'm going to give it a good. I'm going to give it a good because you know what? I think it's definitely worth watching. And something like the submarine scene and the plane scene, but mostly the submarine scene. I really love that scene.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a must-watch scene, and the rest of the movie is pretty middle of the road. It's good enough.
It's about average.
And then there's one scene in it that I found that was absolutely spectacular. So I'm gonna give it a good and say, yeah, you should definitely watch this movie at some point. It's almost tipping to mid-tier garbage, but definitely in the good zone.
Well, you're basically where I'm at then, because my worth of watch is middle of the road, but like I said, it was nearly on like my good. So you're like, we're both in the middle, but you're on the plus side of it, and I'm more on the less side of it, of the middle of the road.
See, when I do mid-tier garbage, it's more like,
that's a scale.
It's fairly average. You know, there's nothing that's that stand out about this that is not going to be another form of content. Like, you're not going to see... Mid-tier garbage is like... You'll see this in another movie. You'll see this in something else. Or maybe it won't be identical. But it's pretty average, you know.
Yeah.
This, I think, did... That's why especially the submarine scene stands out for me, because I think it did something that's very unique.
Yeah.
And you're not just going to see that done in another movie. Even if it's done in another movie, I don't think it will be done as well, because I thought that scene was done so well.
100%.
Which is why I firmly put it in the good category, because it's got something unique to a movie that I think should be watched and I think is very well done.
Good point.
And... Yeah, if you've got one scene that's good, but the rest of the movie's bad, that's not gonna buy you a good. If you've only got one good scene, if the rest of the movie is well enough to support a really spectacularly well done scene, that's a good. But the rest of the movie has to hold up as well.
Maybe we should do a follow up episode where I rewatch the first 6 or 7 and. You catch up on the rest, and maybe we could do a retrospective. Well, maybe.
This one sold me. I'm going to watch the rest of them because
okay.
I was stubborn before, and I was like, 1 and 2 left me with a really bad taste. I was like, I do not care for Mission Impossible. this one showed me that maybe there's something to it.
I think one and two, once again, are like, they feel the most distinctly different. J.J. Abrams pushed three in a more action-heavy direction that feels a little bit more akin to what you're getting now. And then 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are like, if you don't like it by 4,
then I might as well dip out. I see.
Basically, if you don't like 4, forget about 5, 6, and 7.
Well, I liked 7 like enough. Seven was a mid-tier garbage.
Yeah. If you didn't mind 7 and you liked 8, I think you'll like 4, 5, and 6. I don't know about...
All right. I will try them.
I know you don't like 1 and 2. 3 is like the transitional movie between the tone of 2 and 4.
Listen, I pushed through all of 2 because I wanted to try and give it another chance.
2 is the worst.
If I have to push through all of 3 to get to what people consider is good, fine. I will watch 3 and then I'll watch 4, 5, 6 if they're good. And then,
like I said, I think 3 is the transitional of Mission Impossible eras. There's like... It kind of feels like 1 and 2, but also starts feeling like the later ones in some parts. But then 4 on is just...
Okay, I will promise the audience that I won't just watch 3 and quit, even if 3 is bad, because they might be like, 3 is bad too, you have to start at 4. I will push through 3, even if it's bad, and I will watch 4.
I still say peak Mission Impossible. Kind of forget the first trilogy exists. Peak Mission Impossible is 4, 5, 6.
All right.
That's the franchise at its best. Now, I mean, okay, best, like, tightest, I mean. In terms of stunt showcases, this is, like, operating on all cylinders in Final Reckoning here. We're, like, we're doing the best we possibly can do, but I think in terms of movies, 4, 5, and 6 were the tightest all-around packages. Anyway, where can we find you? That's Mission Impossible, Final Reckoning.
You can find me on Instagram at jchurchtpm.
And you can find me on Instagram at ThoughtPlane Media. And check out ThoughtPlane.ca for everything else we do. There's hundreds of posts there for free. And you can donate a buck or two there if you like our work and you're feeling generous. We hope to see you on the next close-up with Ryan and Joe and Justin. Till next time.
Take care.